If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi there and welcome to the Stock Club podcast. I'm James and with me this week is my Wall Street co-founder and chief investor Emmett Savage and our head analyst Rory Caron. Today we're talking about the new generation of TikTok traders and the massive risks they're putting themselves under, what a new president will mean for the US stock market, and our red hot risky contrarian elevator pitches. So guys, earlier this week, one of our followers, Kieran Trainer, tagged us in a video that's doing the rounds on Twitter, showing a couple explaining how they make money from home by trading stocks on Robinhood. I was going to try explain the video, but we might just put in the audio here and let you listen for yourself.
So basically, I just trade stocks on an app called Robinhood, which I left a link in our bio if you want to check it out. It's free to download, free to sign up. They actually give you a free stock, so they're paying you to sign up. But again, not sponsored. And I know trading sounds intimidating. Here's my strategy in a nutshell. I see a stock going up and I buy it and I just watch it until it stops going up and then I sell it, and I do that over and over and it pays for our whole lifestyle. If you're wondering how much you can make doing this, in this month I turned about 400 into 14,000, and in this month I turned less than 1,000 into 20,000.
And honestly, my favorite part about this isn't even the amount of money you can make, but just the fact that we don't have to go to a 9-to-5 job.
Yeah, we can focus on things that we actually enjoy doing. So if you have friends that like want to make money from home, you can tag them or send them a link. Or if you make money this way, share it in the comments so other people know, like, there's more people doing this now.
So timeless advice there from that couple on Twitter. Rory, buying a stock when it's going up and then selling it before it stopped going up. Why didn't you think of that?
I don't know. I'm not very good at that, obviously.
It's so simple.
I just kind of am speechless after listening to that audio. It's, yeah. Emma, you were around doing the rounds during the old tech bubble. Does that sound vaguely familiar to circa 1999?
I actually thought it was a wind-up. When I watched it, I thought, no, that's not real. But, you know, I shudder to admit I've come around to believing that the couple in that video are actually handing out heartfelt advice.
Yeah.
And that is exactly dot-com-ish, yeah.
I went in and watched a few of that guy's other videos, and in one of them, or in a few of them actually, he says, don't take my advice and I might be an idiot, and he might be onto something there. But all joking aside, this video is part of a growing trend on TikTok where we see amateur investors pitching what some might consider very risky stocks, and even pitching option trades on the app. Anne-Marie, one of the new analysts here at My Wall Street, wrote a great piece on this last week. Rory, I wanted to get your take on it, though. What do you think about this younger generation of investors gaining exposure to the market like this?
I think it's great that young people are getting into investing anyway. This is probably not the best way to do it. I think that if you study the history of the stock market, you'll see that this isn't a new thing particular. It's coming in a new form with new mediums like TikTok and Robinhood and kind of the cheap discount brokers, free trades that people are exposed to now, and the, you know, some would say the irresponsible lending that goes on through some of them in terms of margin for options and things like that. But, you know, these things always end badly over the long term. That just has been shown time and time again. It's interesting at a time when people are that young that they're using what is kind of small amounts of money, I suppose, to take very high risks in something like the stock market. And, you know, you can always increase returns by increasing risk. That's how the risk reward payout turns out. And for a lot of them, it might be a very cheap lesson in the long run. You know, they might find out very quickly that this isn't the way to do things and hopefully readjust. I hope it doesn't turn them off investing altogether, that they think this is the only way to do it. But, you know, it's, I suppose, better that they're trying it with small amounts of money.
And
it's just doing a little bit of due diligence on even the people that are giving them the advice would be a good starting point, I think.
Yeah, because they're saying that your failures are your biggest lessons, so it might be good to get those lessons in pretty early. I mentioned option trading there, Rory, too. And can you kind of briefly explain, just for anyone who might not know, what option trading is and why it carries a little bit more risk than just normally investing in stocks?
Well, when you're buying an option, you're not actually investing in a business. You're buying it what's called a derivative. It's a contract which derives its value off another financial asset, and that financial asset is typically in an option, another stock. So what you can do is essentially you can pay for the option, you can buy for the option to buy a stock at a certain price in the future. You're not committed to having to buy the stock at that price, but if you wish to, you know, it's, and you can get options for multiple, for various lengths of time. But if at the time that your option expires and the stock hasn't hit that price tag, your option becomes worthless. So you could end up spending a couple of hundred or maybe even a couple of $1,000 on something that materializes to zero just because it hasn't reached a particular price point. Okay. With buying common equity, you know, you're not adding in that short time frame. Typically you can, you know, wait, a stock can go up and down, it can go much lower than you bought it for, much higher than you bought it for, but you know, if you're thinking out in 5 or 10 years, you don't have that kind of time where you have to, where something could suddenly become zero, you know, out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Emmett buys, you do some option trading, Emmett, don't you?
Yeah, I have. I mean, it's not something that's core to my investment philosophy, and I think I'd make about at most one or two option trades in a year. In fact, that's on a busy year. I'd say over the last 5 to 10 years, I've probably done about, I'd say by 10 options trades, and the majority of them have worked out because I only go that route when I see it as a no-brainer, where something is just so obviously broken that I decide to leverage what I've got for that particular opportunity. So yeah, I use it. And as I've said before, it's analogous to English mustard on a dinner plate. You put a tiny amount there and it will make or break your dinner depending on how you use it.
I've heard that analogy before.
I've got an idea. I've got an idea for a new TikTok video of Emmett trying out different mustards.
Some of the stuff that's going on with TikTok and TikTok investors is a Twitter account that I follow, which kind of aggregates the best, or in this case, kind of the worst. The worst are the best of the TikTok investing community. But then, like, just some kind of mad stuff happens. Like, there was a stock that Carol Baskins from Tiger King mentioned, that ended up something like 250%. Now, and that wasn't on TikTok. I think she did it on a Cameo video, you know, one of these platforms where people can pay people to give shout outs to things. So was she paid to say this by someone?
Yeah. Could she get done for stock manipulation?
Well, like, she's nuts. She's a private individual acting. Someone just asked her to say the name of this stock and it went up like 250%.
Joe Exotic trying to frame her again.
Why anyone thinks Carol Baskin has any like expertise in the stock market, I don't know. But that's the kind of mad stuff that's happening on TikTok.
It's like recently when Elon Musk tweeted, buy Signal, wasn't it? And this company called Signal went up, I don't know how many fold in value. And he was actually talking about the messaging app, which kind of just shows people not really doing their due diligence on these stocks. Emmett, something Rory mentioned earlier was the dot-com crash, and which is probably the most famous bubble of recent years. Is there any parallels you can see about this, or does this kind of get your a bad feeling in your gut when you see people behaving like this?
Yes, I certainly do have a bad feeling in my gut about some of the behavior I see, and I have to check it because, you know, history doesn't always repeat itself. So what I don't want to draw too many parallels between what we're seeing now in the late 90s, because the great conclusion of May 2000 was that the House of Cards came tumbling down. And, you know, by kind of going there again, it's as if to suggest that everything is about to take a tumble, which it may not do. However, I do think that what we're looking at is the exact same human behavior just presenting itself in new channels. Yeah. And for example, Robin Hood now has led the way for a new era of stock investors, which is a good thing. And it's primarily led by the fact that they're mobile only, or as far as I know, mobile only or mobile first, and that they have zero commissions. And, you know, about, I suppose maybe 15 years ago, there was an online broker called Zecco, which I think was acquired by Ally or Ally, I never know how to pronounce them, A-L-L-Y, Ally, and they were zero commissions.
Yeah.
So they're like, what Robinhood is doing has been done before. What we see on TikTok or what we see on Twitter with regard to public commentary has been done before. In the late 90s, you could go into Yahoo Finance. Any publicly listed business had a discussion board, and on those discussion boards, you could get involved with other people to discuss that stock. And it was usually, it was crazy stuff. Like there was people trying to, there was a mix of people who had done some reasonable due diligence on a stock with those people who are just screaming buy. I know somebody who works in here and they've told me they're about to acquire XYZ Corp and this is going to be ginormous. So, you know, TikTok as a medium for me doesn't resonate because I'm 46 years old. I just don't use it. My son's using it. My younger son uses it. And in fact, he might think it's very uncool for me to even admit that. So like really it appeals to a younger generation. But I was looking on the 31st of December, just gone by, TikTok, the hashtag investing had amassed 1 billion views.
Yeah.
On TikTok. So that's a lot of mind space occupancy it's earned. And from those billion views, there is unquestionably a subset who, for that reason and for TikTok existing, will be lifelong stock investors and will make mistakes and will lose money and will kind of learn the hard way, but they will reemerge and actually changed their life as a consequence of interacting with these platforms. And, you know, there's creators on TikTok who are explaining the stock market in fun and snappy and short and, you know, image-led ways. And that's a good thing, I think. And alongside the billion views that the hashtag investing had on TikTok at the end of December, the hashtag stock talk had about a quarter of a billion views. So, you know, there is a lot of new investors who haven't even yet hit their teens who are taking an interest in this. And yeah, that's good. I just really hope, as Rory says, that lessons are learned with small amounts of money and that ultimately people start to separate signal from noise, which is what we're here to do. We deliver a signal and we leave the noise out there.
Very nice plug to get in there at the end. If you want to read more about this, make sure to check out Anne-Marie's article that I mentioned, What is Option Trading and Why is it All over TikTok? That's in the My Wall Street app right now. Let's move on then. I should probably mention that we're actually recording this episode on Wednesday, January the 20th. And as we're speaking, the inauguration of Joe Biden as the 46th president of the United States is taking place. Barring any more attempted coups, this inauguration should see a new commander-in-chief taking over that has many different views on issues compared to his predecessor. From an investor's point of view, we'll be looking closely at things like increased corporate taxes, COVID stimulus packages, big tech regulation, and the potential of things like the Green New Deal to be resurrected. Rory, what do you think are going to be the biggest changes that investors notice with a new administration coming in?
Yeah, with the disclaimer, and I think Emma's going to touch it further on about how the president actually has very little impact on the stock market on average. Over the short term, things you mentioned already, there is a stimulus package which the Biden administration is proposing, which is going to be $1.9 trillion. Sounds like an awful lot of money, but it's a big problem that they're facing at the moment.
Yeah.
Part of that package is increased unemployment benefits, which began actually, you know, back last March when the pandemic first hit, but expired. So they were giving people $600 extra a week on top of their statewide unemployment benefits, and that expired. They did a $300 a week one, and that's set to expire in March. And now this new one is going to be an extra $400 on top of that. This again scheduled to end in September. I don't particularly understand the idea of starting and stopping all these programs. The idea of ending unemployment insurance is typically to encourage people to go back to work. Doesn't really make much sense when there's no jobs to go back to. Another part of the plan, one that was very popular with Americans, is to send everyone a check, essentially, and looks like there'll be a check of $1,400 on top of the $600 that was already paid out earlier this year. Now, that's something that absolutely could impact the market over the short term because it's not targeted relief. It's something that, you know, politically goes down very well. Who doesn't want to see money been dropped into their bank accounts. But if you don't need that money, you know, I mean, really, there should be, if I was in charge, or, you know, and God forsake, you know, you would, yeah, I feel like that money could much better be spent on people who really do need it. And, you know, back in at the start of the pandemic, it was a rush. It was just get people in money's pockets. Don't worry about, you know, figuring out who needs it. Just make sure there's money going around so people aren't starving.
And funnily enough, just sorry to cut across here, Rory, but that goes back to what we were just talking about, that a lot of the kind of recovery of the stock market was related to the fact that a lot of these people weren't struggling on a day-to-day basis, so invested the money, the check they got, into the market.
Yeah, no, and this is, I was right about to come to that. The fact
Sorry,
is that
I ruined
people,
your lead in
yeah,
there.
Yeah, you did, kind of, whatever. but no, an awful lot of people, you know, as much as there was huge job losses when this pandemic kicked off last year, an awful lot of people didn't lose their job. An awful lot of people were able to work from home. And those people who did end up working from home were typically saving money on things like commuting, you know, going out to eat in restaurants, going out to bars, getting their lunch out. So getting money dropped into their accounts was money that they really didn't need. And what were they going to do with it? You either save it, you consume it, or you invest it. And a lot of people did decide to invest it. And we see data that shows that when those checks go in, people started trading more stocks across all income groups. Recipients traded roughly 30% more in the first 10 days of January than at the start of December. That was right after the second round of checks came out. And trading among those with annual incomes of less than $75,000 jumped 53%. So, and you see this across various data sets, like volume in penny stocks, for example, is topping 400 billion shares a day lately. That's up sixfold from a year ago. And you're seeing the options markets, what's second busiest day ever for bullish equity calls just last week. So all this, you know, is feeding into the short-term impacts on the market. If you give people money, they have to do something with it. And a lot of people are going to penny stocks, they're going to options trading, and it's pumping up prices very high. Over the longer term, it is more opaque. You know, even though the Democrats control both houses of Congress now and the presidency, Biden hasn't got a blank check to enact whatever policies he wants. You know, there's a lot of well-publicized infighting in the Democratic Party between the more progressive wing and the centrists. Someone like Joe Manchin, for example, who's a Democratic senator from West Virginia, I believe, you know, with a one-vote margin in the Senate, he now holds a huge amount of power when it comes to controlling and shaping policy.
However,
some have argued, and I wrote a piece about this, I think, was it last week or the week before, that Biden could actually achieve an awful lot in his administration through essentially enforcing laws that are already on the books, especially when it comes to antitrust. And this is something that we did see a lot of big movement at the end of the year. That includes, you know, just pressing the heads of government bodies that he now controls to take action against anti-competitive behavior. And you'd be looking at the old offenders, Amazon, Facebook, Google. And this is something that, you know, Scott Galloway would say could oxygenate the economy, you know, give, you know, trickle down economics, not to people down in terms of the class, but actually let smaller companies thrive. And, you know, even in our business, we've seen the benefits of that already with that.
Yeah.
That cut that Apple made to their to the commissions that they're taking, that was a proactive move that they took to in order to kind of avoid bigger scrutiny. So, you know, that kind of thing can grow the economy, can equalize things quite a lot. And, you know, more so, the Biden campaign did focus around this idea of trying to heal a divided nation. So from an outside observer, that seems like it's going to be very difficult going forward with legislation. Things like the Green New Deal are pretty partisan. You know, one side hates them, the other side likes them, and there's a constant fight to get those things across the line. However, you know, there is kind of one thing that is broadly popular across the political spectrum in America, and that is the idea of breaking up big tech companies.
Yeah.
There was a recent poll by Data for Progress that showed 74% of Republicans and 80% of Democrats were either very concerned or somewhat concerned about monopolies. And something like two-thirds were up for the idea of breaking up the big companies. And again, there was no real significant Democratic-Republican divide on that question. So that's actually like something that the administration could come in and become a kind of trust-busting administration, similar to the, you know, FDR or Teddy Roosevelt.
Yeah, interesting. It could be something as well that actually maybe hopefully heals a lot of the rifts too, if they go in with something that has that cross-board support. Emmett, I want to come over to you, and In our chat with Morgan Housel a few months ago, I remember him mentioning that the effects of a sitting president on the market and the economy at large are often quite exaggerated or overstated. Would you agree with that sentiment?
Oh, completely. And in fact, according to Jeremy Segal, the author of Stocks for the Long Run, which is a terrific book that I recommend people read if they're into the subject, according to Segal, Wall Street's obsession with politics is really misplaced. And he says, and I quote, "Bull markets and bear markets come and go, and it's more to do with business cycles than presidents." Yeah. Now, when you look, I had a look at how stock markets have performed under different administrations, and Forbes wrote a piece just a few months ago that stacked ranked the S&P 500 returns beside the different presidents that were in term. And the number one performing market as coinciding with a president happened to be Bill Clinton, which is 93 to the years 93 to 2001, which is really the run-up to the dot-com bubble. So when you kind of read down through the league table of presidents or rather political parties in office, when stacked ranked against the S&P 500 returns, there is no pattern. Like there was a common misconception, I should say, that, you know, markets perform better with Republican presidents, which is completely incorrect. That's not correct. No more than the opposite is correct. You can't actually infer that one particular party is better for the stock market. So if I may, I'm going to read down through just the ranking, starting in top spot. So Clinton, the market performed best when Clinton was office, followed second by Barack Obama. Third place was Eisenhower, who, as we know, is Republican. Ronald Reagan was next, Republican. Harry Truman, 1945 to 1953, was the fifth best performing market, and he was a Democrat, followed by George W. Bush, Republican, followed by Lyndon Johnson, who was Democrat, followed by Donald Trump, who was Republican, followed by Jimmy Carter, who was Democrat, followed by Gerald Ford, who was Republican, followed by Kennedy, who was Democrat. So it's literally...
Yeah.
On off, Republican, Democrat. So really, you can't infer anything from the data. Yeah. So for those people out there who think that a market performs better under one political party or the other, they're simply misguided. That is not correct. What really matters is the backdrop, and presidents do the best with the resources they have to make sure that their country prospers, as I'm sure the new president will do. That's really all we can say about it. So I absolutely do agree with Morgan's point, and it was certainly backed up by Jeremy Segal in his book, Stocks for the Long Run.
Yeah, and as Rory mentioned there, people seem to be under the mistaken belief sometimes that a new president comes in with a blank slate to enact all of their policies, when in reality they're often quite restricted in what they can do. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see how the next few months play out. Before we move on, I want to touch quickly on Netflix's earnings, which, as I mentioned, we're recording on Wednesday, and they reported on their quarter four and full year earnings last night. It was a pretty impressive display, to say the least, by the streaming giant, but I want to focus on two of the big takeaways that people seem to be focusing on today. The fact that the company has now passed 200 million total subscribers, and expectation that they'll become cash flow positive after this year. Emma, I'll come to you about the subscriber number. How significant is it that Netflix have now hit over 200 million total subscribers?
It is significant. I mean, 200 million is just another number, and it's just a milestone that we put, you know, in our own minds. But yeah, actually, it's funny because when I first invested in Netflix, the ambition was to get to 6 million subscribers. And at the time, I thought that was outlandish. They had, I think, 275,000 subscribers. And now we're talking about hundreds of millions. And it's great. I mean, it is a bigger deal than the 200 million numbers, the fact that Netflix expects to be cash flow positive.
So do you want to explain that just a little bit first? You know, what does it mean for a company to be cash flow positive?
Well, it means they no longer need outside financing, and in Netflix's case, to help with content development. So, and that is a big deal, because really only quarters ago, Netflix was burning through cash in order to keep the content machine going. And what we're looking at now is that they are now standing financially on their own two feet. The content library is getting bigger. The brand has enlarged. The backdrop of coronavirus, the tailwind, has basically pushed their business model forward. And conversations about Netflix versus Disney Plus are starting to bubble up, I've noticed. And I won't necessarily, you know, go down that rabbit hole. But I believe they do not compete, believe it or not, because Disney Plus produces content for family. Netflix, you know, is for all people and it has slightly grittier content. But ultimately, Netflix is a mega brand. It's the mega brand that I think most adults interact with. So, you know, when you look at Fang or Fat Man, depending on which of the giants, you know, the list of giants you look at, Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Netflix, Tesla. Netflix is the brand that, when it comes to spending money, I think most adults will have interacted with, because not everyone will have a Tesla. Not everyone buys into Facebook and its family of products. You know, not everybody will shop on Amazon, although it's probably close. But I think Netflix is one of those brands that has just permeated society. And if you speak to somebody and find they don't have Netflix, it's actually a surprise. Yeah. So I think that Netflix will continue to go from strength to strength because the entire strategic delivery chain is theirs now at this stage. They have content creation, distribution, and ownership, which I think is a very, very powerful position.
What do you think, Rory? I know one of the bear arguments that was often posited against Netflix was the fact that, you know, I think last year they had earmarked something like $17 billion to spend on content. Now, I'm not sure if they spent that full amount, but that's an incredible cash burn.
Yeah, the fact that is the biggest takeaway from this earnings by far was that management said they no longer need to raise cash. They're able to finance the operations day to day. I mean, it only took them 200 million subs and $25 billion in revenue to get there, but they got there. And they believe they're going to be able to sustain this going forward. They even floated the idea of stock buybacks, which is just crazy to think. I mean, they actually did do stock buybacks a long time ago.
I was just about to say that, and they got absolutely slated for it, didn't they?
Yeah, so, but I mean, the fact that they're even talking about it now is something that I don't think many people would have imagined 2-3 years ago. Some of the other kind of highlights from it was revenues are up 21.5% a quarter. That's the 31st consecutive quarter that they've increased revenues by more than 20%.
Wow.
Now, contrary to that, it was the lowest increase year-over-year growth they've seen since way back in 2013. But still growing at over 20% despite their size. Netflix series accounted for 9 of the 10 most searched shows globally in 2020. Which, again, that just shows you the incredible monopoly they have worldwide on mindshare when it comes to television programming. And this, I thought this was interesting, you know, like the fact that Disney Plus had a massive first year. I think they got 87 million paid subscribers. And yet Netflix recorded the biggest year-over-year paid membership growth in their history. So that blows the Disney Plus competition argument right out the window. It's clear that people are going to have both in the household, because Disney Plus has a very specific target audience, which is children, and adults still want a form of entertainment, and Netflix is still able to grow in this environment. So, you know, it was really great report from Netflix. I'm sure it's going to be, the market hasn't opened as I'm speaking, but I'm sure it's going to be rewarded.
Absolutely. So let's take a look at some of the other things that are going on in my Wall Street at the minute. So far this month, we've already published January's Stock of the Month selection, as well as our exclusive subscriber-only podcast, the Stock of the Month podcast. Earlier this week, we also added a brand new stock to the shortlist. Rory, you were talking recently about how hard it was to actually find good opportunities at the minute, considering that a lot of stocks are very highly valued. How did you find this company?
Throwing darts at a dartboard. Yeah, that's one or the other. No, this is a business I've been looking at for a while. It's in traditional retail to an extent, but also, of course, every retailer now has the e-commerce wing. And it was a business that it's one of those ones where there's certain things that don't tick all the boxes as an investment that we usually make. People can read the piece, but certainly the owner's a bit of a... spicy grape might be the best term to use.
A character. We say they're a character.
He's a character. But it's just an interesting business. I think it's one of the most interesting plays in the retail space. And yeah, it was tough. It was a tough month. Just every stock you look at, there's loads of great companies out there to invest in. Valuations have just become very steep right now.
When can we...
That was a great find, Rory. It's the first time I heard of the company when it appeared in the app. Really enjoyed reading about it.
When can we expect the TikTok video pitching stocks, Rory? Silence. Okay, I'll move on. Yeah. So remember, if you're not yet a member of the My Wall Street community but want to check out all of this great investing information, you can sign up today and start your free trial by just clicking the link in the notes for the show. Jargon Busters, so Emmett, the first question I'm going to throw over to you, and this question comes off the back of some recent announcements by companies like Zoom and Lemonade that they're planning secondary offerings of shares. Can you just explain really quickly what a secondary share offering actually is and why it's sometimes seen as a negative for investors?
Yeah, so a secondary share offering in the context that we're discussing it for IPO'd companies is when a company has a follow-on and issues new shares. So there's new shares out in the marketplace, which has the effect of dilution. Yeah. And, you know, it's generally the conversation is that, you know, secondary offering isn't good because of that dilution. But there's a couple of, like, that's not the true story, if you ask me. So, you know, what in fact it says, the business is raising new capital to do new things. And if it's an early stage company and there's demand for those shares, you can actually infer from it that this is actually a good thing. So secondary offerings are when a company issues new shares after going public with the net effect of having some dilution, most, I suppose, easily read from the earnings per share. And it also tells us that the company needs cash, and what it's raising the capital for is the real question. And I generally don't mind secondary offerings because businesses need forms of liquidity, and this is one of the many options available to the management teams of businesses.
And it's probably a sign as well that the company's raising money for more R&D and things like that too.
Absolutely. So, I mean, they can, raising capital or finance debt, you know, for acquisitions or, as you say, R&D, or to basically enter new markets, new products, pay down debt. There's so many different ways that a business can use its capital, require capital, and this is just one
Absolutely.
Of them.
Okay, so the next question, Rory, I'm going to throw over to you, and this is one we've actually talked about a few times on Stock Club. Recently, there's been a lot of interest in renewable energy and so-called green stocks, probably due to increasing awareness of our impact on the environment and also the transition of a more green-friendly administration into power in the US. If someone wanted to add green stocks or more renewable energy stocks to their portfolio, how would you advise them?
Yeah, and this is we've talked about this a couple of times before. It's one of the hardest ones for me to talk about because it's like renewable energy is something that absolutely aligns with the values of our company. You know, we want to invest in green energy companies, and we do think green energy is part of the future. But I've valued green energy companies before, solar companies before. It's very complex. It's similar to how we talk about energy companies. There's an area of specialization there, an area of expertise that I think most people don't have. It's not simply as easy as saying, right, well, this company makes solar panels, therefore they're going to be bigger in 10 years than they are today. So the best way of investing in that sense is to do something like through an ETF. And unfortunately, most ETFs that focus on green energy have had just terrible runs for the last 10 years. Now, there was a big spike starting around this time last year, and some of them have gone up multiple fold since then. Mm. But over the kind of the course of the past 10 years, they were terrible investments. So there wasn't really an outlet in order to invest into renewable energies in that sense. The best thing to do was to find a company that was linked to the renewable energy play, something like Tesla, for example. And, you know, obviously Tesla's done very well, but like finding individual renewable energy companies, unless you've got some area of expertise in solar power generation or wind power generation, it's something I would definitely stay away from.
Yeah. Okay, interesting. Finally, we always get a lot of questions in asking for our opinion on specific companies that are not in the My Wall Street shortlist. And recently, we were asked about a company called HubSpot. This is a company that develops marketing software. Rory, you've done a bit of digging on HubSpot before, haven't you?
Yeah, we used to be HubSpot customers. This is way back when the business was just starting. We actually went into their offices, which are just their European headquarters, were just around the corner from our Dublin offices, and met a sales rep there, and they were lovely people. And I do remember, Emma, I think you went in a separate time to me, but I remember being there as well, where it was just like people working all over the place, like working on the floor. I think it was before they moved into their new building. They were obviously growing so fast at that stage. They couldn't actually seat people.
We should have ran back to the office and recommended them, saying these guys are just, you know, bursting at the seams. You know?
I think, you know what turned me off wanting to invest in them was that because we used them and the platform just didn't really work for us, did it? It was like...
No, it didn't.
I distinctly remember there was no copy and paste functionality. I remember that distinctly as being you couldn't... I'm sure there was, but you couldn't just right click and copy and paste something. It used to drive me mad. More than that, I think perhaps it just wasn't the right platform for us as a business, and it took us a while to come to terms with that, and there was a lock-in, and I think it just kind of left a sour taste in our mouths. So that's a good example of like when a real-life experience probably blinds you to what is a broader opportunity.
Yeah, you often talk about that in terms of Roku, don't you?
Yeah, I've told the Roku story a couple of times. Etsy was another one where I had a really bad early experience with Etsy, and I didn't even look at the stock for years, and Jason Moser finally turned me around. Looking at them now, I mean, I just took a look because I knew we were going to talk about it today. As a company, they've maintained pretty solid revenue growth over the last kind of 10 years, seen good gross margin expansion, kind of what you'd expect. They do. I think they have a strength, which is barriers to exit, which we experienced as a young business. Once you're in, it's hard to wean yourself off them. And that's a great economic moat to have. However, then this is just a real kind of glance at the business now. Their net dollar retention isn't quite up there with its peers in the space. That would be a little bit of a red flag to me. I know that's going to happen, considering the market that they target is kind of small and medium-sized businesses. But that's the thing, if they try and then expand further up market, they're going to go against the likes of Salesforce, the likes of Adobe, and those guys are well positioned to beat them in that space. And another thing, a little bit of a, not red flag, but like something that would worry me, is they've never gotten into that top quadrant in Gartner's research. Now, that's only one research company, but as we've talked about before, that tends to be a self-fulfilling prophecy. Yeah. CTOs do hold Gartner in higher regard, and if they don't see a company in that quadrant, they might end up passing on them just based on that alone.
Okay, great. Thanks for that, Rory. So let's move on to the final part of the podcast, which is, of course, the elevator pitch. In our end of year podcast that went live about a month ago, Emmett, you made a very, very contrarian pitch that Macy's stock would become a two-bagger in the coming year. A lot of our listeners really like this pitch, so I've decided to ask you guys today to give me your most contrarian stock pitch possible today. Of course, these pitches come with the big disclaimer that they're just an opinion and should not be taken as investment advice. Emmett, I'll come to you first. What's your next, I suppose, contrarian stock pitch?
I'm going to go even hotter, whiter, hot risk than Macy's.
Okay, hold on. Let me just hold on to my chair.
Like, this is uber contrarian. And I have to say that AMC Cinema Group is in intensive care and it may not pull through. It is, we all know the backdrop. I don't need to tell our listeners why cinemas are in trouble. But last night, and as you said earlier, James, we're recording this on Wednesday afternoon. But last night, Tuesday evening, AMC announced that they had a new line of credit. Now, let me just give just a very quick explanation of AMC at the moment. They're $3 and change. They were something like $33 about 4 years ago. Their market cap, as I speak, is about $660 million, and I presume the vast majority of their cinemas are shut. And back in October, they warned through an SEC filing that they were in deep trouble. And they said, and I quote, "The company anticipates that existing cash resources will be largely depleted by the end of 2020 or early 2021. And as you can imagine, shares went further south. So they effectively announced to the SEC last October that they were dead.
Yeah.
Now, last night, they jumped 30% in after hours trading, and it's 3 o'clock. I presume the markets are open now. And I don't know where they're trading at the moment, but I'd be quite sure it's above $3. And they said that they have announced, or they announced last night, that they're going to get $100 million in debt with an interest rate of 15%, and that the company doesn't have to make its first interest payment until July. So what we're looking at here is a lifeline. And the reason this is a contrarian pick is that we're looking at a penny stock at $3 and change, with a lifeline to get to midsummer. And what we are doing here, and I hate to use the word bet, I never use the word bet in this profession because we don't make bets, but this is a bet on cinemas reopening by midsummer. AMC being one of those, and them taking in enough money to furnish the debt, and if they manage to get the whole kit and caboodle under control, I believe that Three Books will look something like the lowest point in their history.
Wow. That is a contrarian bet. I'm a big fan of cinemas. I definitely wouldn't be investing in a cinema stock at the moment, but you know, I think some cinema chain has to survive. We'll wait and see. Rory, what about you?
Yeah, over the long term, I'm going to stick with one in our showroom, and I think that over the long term, it is going to get out of a rut that it's in, and that's Eventbrite.
Yep.
It's basically been a loser from the day we added it. Maybe it was 2 years ago now, and that was the kind of combination between a botched or definitely, you know, not perfectly executed acquisition of one of their biggest competitors, which was Ticket Fly, and then obviously the global pandemic, which cancelled all events globally for the last 12 months. So the reason I'm going to stick with it is because I still like the business. I think the area that they operate in, the local event, is going to be a massive part of the entertainment market going forward over the next 10 decades. I still like management, despite the hiccups they've had along the road. And I think that this pandemic, for all the damage that it's caused, could at least give them that breathing space in order to iron out the problems that they had with that big acquisition. Now, the big kind of disclaimer on that is it only works out if they survive.
Because
a company can't survive on the 20, 30 million revenue that they're generating each quarter now. So that's the kind of disclaimer on it. Can they maintain the capital to survive and how long this pandemic's going to last?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a shareholder in Eventbrite, so I really hope you're right. So that's it from this week's Stock Club. Don't forget about all the great new stuff in My Wall Street at the moment. If there's anything you want us to discuss or explain on the next episode, please make sure to get in touch with us. You can find us on Twitter, that's at My Wall Street HQ, or email us at pod@mywallstreet.com. That's pod@mywallstreet.com. Don't forget to subscribe to Stock Club, and if you're enjoying the podcast, leave a review for us on whatever platform you listen to us on. From the three of us here today, we'll talk to you in 2 weeks. Happy investing.
Liberty's leave policy was tremendous. Having the ability to take 16 weeks off, fully paid to bond with my child, was an incredible experience.
At Liberty Mutual, you can find a career that supports you at every step, even baby steps. We offer up to 16 weeks parental leave for new moms and dads. And because not everyone's pathway to parenthood looks the same, we offer robust fertility, surrogacy, and adoption benefits too. Learn more at libertymutualcareers.com and pursue your tomorrow today.